then there remains no occasion for the rod. It is this dwelling upon favorite portions of truth to the exclusion of all others which led many into grievous errors. The non-imputation of sin to believers and the chastening of sin in believers are both plainly taught in the Scriptures. See, for example, 2 Samuel 12, 13 and 14, where both facts are mentioned side by side, and whether or not they can be reconciled to mere human reason, both must be firmly held by us. As Matthew Henry tersely expressed it, in the doctrine of Christ, there are paradoxes which to men of corrupt minds are stumbling stones. Unquote. It is the twofoldness of truth which has, in part, furnished occasion for infidels to declare that the Bible is full of contradictions, for being blind spiritually, they are unable to perceive the perfect harmony of the whole. To what a sorry pass have things come, then, when we find some who wish to be regarded as the very champions of orthodoxy, making the same charge against those who contend for the entire faith once delivered to the saints. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, is the standard which must be applied to the pulpit equally with the law court. One element of truth must not be pressed to such an extreme that another be denied, but each given its due and distinctive place. It is a favorite device of Satan's to drive us from one extreme to another. This may be seen by observing the order to the temptations which he set before the Savior. First, he sought to overthrow Christ's faith, bring him to doubt the word of God and his goodness unto him. He has proclaimed from heaven that thou art his beloved son, yet he is suffering thee to starve to death here in the wilderness. As is clear from his "If thou be the Son of God," prefacing his command that these stones be made bread. Finding that he had failed to prevail by such an assault, Satan then took a clean contrary course in his next attack, seeking to bring the Lord Jesus to act presumptuously. "If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge concerning thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou dash thy foot against a stone." The force of which was, "Since thou art so fully assured of the Father's loving care, demonstrate thy confidence in his protection. Since thy faith in his word is so unshakable, count upon his promise that no harm shall befall thee, even though thou castest thyself from the pinnacle of the temple." This has been recorded for our learning, for it makes manifest to us that guile of the devil and the cunning tactics which he employs, especially that of swinging from one extreme to another. Let it be steadily borne in mind that as he dealt there with Christ the head, so Satan continues to act with all his members. If he cannot bring them to one extreme, he will endeavor to drive them to another. If he cannot bring a man to covetousness and miserliness, then he will attempt to drive him to prodigality and thriftlessness. If a man be of the sober and somber type, let him beware lest the devil, in condemning him for this, leads him into levity and irreverence. The devil cannot endure one who turns not either to the right hand or to the left, Isaiah 30:21. Nevertheless, we must labor to keep the golden mean, neither darting on the one hand or presuming on the other, neither giving way to despair nor to recklessness. Let us not forget that truth itself may be misused. 2 Peter 3:16, and the very grace of God turned into lasciviousness. Jude 4. Solemn warnings are these. Commit thy way unto the Lord, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. Psalm 37:5. That is a blessed promise, yet I altogether pervert the same if I use it to the neglect of duty and sit down and do nothing. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free. Galatians 5:1. That is an important precept, yet I put it to a wrong use if I so stand up for my own rights that I exercise no love unto the brethren, who are kept by the power of God through faith unto salvation, ready to be revealed in the last day. 1 Peter 1:5, that too is a blessed promise, yet it does not exempt me from using all proper means for my preservation. The Christian farmer knows that unless God is pleased to bless his labors, he will reap no harvest, but that does not hinder him from plowing and harrowing. Let us close these remarks by a helpful quotation from one who showed the perfect consistency between Romans 8:38 and 39 and 1 Corinthians 9:27. But I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. Charles Hodge on 1 Corinthians wrote, "The reckless and listless Corinthians thought they could safely indulge themselves to the very verge of sin, while this devoted apostle considered himself as engaged in a life struggle for his salvation. The same apostle, however, who evidently acted on the principle that the righteous scarcely are saved and that the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, at other times breaks out in the most joyous assurance of salvation and says that he was persuaded that nothing in heaven, earth, or hell could ever separate him from the love of God. The one state of mind is the necessary condition of the other. It is only those who are conscious of this constant and deadly struggle with sin to whom this assurance is given. In the very same breath, Paul says, 'O wretched man that I am, and thanks be to God who giveth us the victory.' Romans 7:24 and 25. It is the indolent and self-indulgent Christian who is always in doubt, to which we may add, as it is the empty professor who is filled with a carnal confidence." Unquote. Chapter 8, its elucidation. Had we followed a strictly logical order, this branch of our subject would have followed right after our discussion of the problem which is raised by this doctrine. But we deemed it better to first build a broader foundation for our present remarks by considering its complement, wherein we should first the twofoldness of truth which characterizes the whole of divine revelation. Second, that parallel with the fact of man's spiritual impotency runs his full responsibility. Third, that the acid test of sound theology consists in preserving the balance of truth or presenting its component parts in their proper perspective. Fourth, that the servant of God must ever strive to set forth each aspect of the gospel in its fair proportions, being impervious to the charge of inconsistency, which is sure to be hurled at him by extremists. Let us now restate the problem to which this and the following articles endeavor to present a solution. How can fallen man be held responsible to glorify God when he is incapable of doing so? How can it consist with the mercy of God for him to require the debt of obedience when we are unable to pay it? How can it consist with the justice of God to punish with eternal suffering for the neglect of what lay altogether beyond the sinner's power? A fallen man be bound fast with the cords of sin? With what propriety can God demand of him the performance of a perfect holiness? Since a sinner is the slave of sin, how can he be a free agent? Can we really be held accountable for not doing what it is impossible for us to do? If the fall has not annulled human responsibility, must it not, to a considerable extent, have modified it? Let it be said that it is not for the benefit of the carping critic or the objecting infidel that we take up such questions as these, but with the desire to help our fellow Christians. Though such problems do not to the least degree shake their confidence in the character of the Lord or the integrity of His Word, yet some believers are at a loss to see how His ways can be equal. On the one hand, Scripture declares, "The carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be, and therefore incapable of doing anything else but sin." So then, they that are in the flesh cannot please God. Romans 8:7-8. Yet, on the other, we are informed that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Romans 1:18. And that every transgression and disobedience shall receive a just recompense of reward. Hebrews 2:2. Nor is any deliverance from God's wrath obtainable through the gospel, except upon such conditions as no natural man can comply with. Nevertheless, a non-compliance with those conditions brings additional condemnation. Unto not a few who give serious thought to this subject, it almost seems to make out the Most High to be what the slothful servant said, "Reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strewn." Matthew 25:24. That such is far from being the true state of the case, every regenerate heart is fully assured. Yet the removal of this God-dishonoring suspicion is earnestly desired by those perplexed hereupon. These points have engaged the mind of the writer for many years past, and it is now our desire to pass on to other members of the household of faith what has been a help to us that these articles are being written. How fallen man can be morally impotent yet morally responsible is the matter we shall endeavor to elucidate. In seeking the solution to our problem, we shall first aim to cast upon it the light furnished by the relationship which exists between the Creator and the creature, between God and fallen man. When facing the difficulties raised by the truth of the moral impotency of fallen man, it is of vast importance that we clearly recognize and tenaciously hold fast the fact that God has not forfeited His right over the creature, even though the creature has lost his power to meet God's requirements. It is at this point especially much of the difficulty is removed. Further light is thrown upon the nature of human responsibility by obtaining a right view of man's moral agency. So too, by far the greater part of the difficulty vanishes when we correctly define and state the nature of man's impotency, what it is not, and what it does consist of. finally, it will be found that man's own conscience and consciousness bears witness to the fact of his accountability. In seeking to show the relationship which exists between the Creator and the creature, between God and the fallen man, let us inquire, what is the foundation of moral obligation? What is the rule of human duty? It should be evident to any anointed eye. There can be only one answer to these questions, the will of God. The will of God is revealed to us. God is our Maker, and as such, He has the right to unlimited control over the creatures of His hands. That right of God is absolute, uncontrolled, and without any limitation. It is the right of the potter over the clay. Moreover, the creature is entirely dependent upon the Creator. In Him we live and move and have our being. He that formeth the spirit of man within him sustains that spirit and the body which it inhabits. In reference to our bodies, we have no self-sustaining power. Let God's hand be withdrawn, and it returns to the dust. Equally dependent upon the sustaining power of God is the soul of man. Because God is who He is, and because man is the work of His hands, the will of God must be the foundation of moral obligation. All things were created by Him and for Him. Colossians 1:16. Thou hast created all things. For Thy pleasure they are and were created. Revelation 4:11. But God is not only our Creator, He is also our ruler and governor, and His rights over us are made known by His will, by His expressed will. Man is bound to do what God commands and to abstain from what He forbids, simply because He commands and forbids. Beyond that, there is no reason. Direct reference to the divine will is essential to any moral virtue. When an action is done regardless of God's will, no honor is shown to Him and no virtue pertains to it, such as the clear and definite teaching of Holy Writ. It knows no foundation of right or wrong, no obligation, but the will of the Most High. It therefore follows that the will of God revealed is the rule of duty. It is self-evident that the will of God cannot direct and govern us save as it is made known to us, and in His Word it is made known. God's own rule of action is His will. For higher and holier rule there can be none. He doeth according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. Daniel 4:35. He saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. Romans 9:15. To the will of God, our blessed Redeemer uniformly referred as both the obligation and rule of His own action. I delight to do Thy will, O my God. Yea, Thy law is within my heart. Psalm 40, verse 8. I seek not mine own will, but the will of the Father which hath sent me. John 5:30. Even when the desire of His sinless humanity was for an escape from the awful cup, His holy soul felt the binding obligation of the divine will. Not as I will, but as Thou wilt. Does not that settle the question once for all? If the incarnate Son looked no higher, no lower, no farther, why should you? Compliance with the will of God, because it is the will of God, is the perfection of moral virtue. It is a striking fact that whenever the heart of man is pierced by the arrows of the Almighty, and his soul bowed down before the majesty of heaven, whenever he begins to feel the awful burden of his guilt and his conscience is agitated over his fearful accountabilities and how they are to be met, his inquiry always is, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? Every reader who has been taught of God knows this to be true. There is, therefore, a revealed testimony in every renewed heart to the righteousness of God's rule and the reality of its obligation. This is the basic principle of Christian fidelity and fortitude. Under its influence, the regenerate soul has only one inquiry in reference to any proposed enterprise. Is it the will of God? Satisfied of this, his heart tells him it must be done. Difficulties, hardships, dangers, death present no obstacle. Onward he presses in the path marked out for him by the will of his Father. Obedience to that is his only responsibility. Let the reader then seek to grasp firm hold of this important fact that the whole question of man's responsibility resolves itself into this. Hath God revealed, hath God commanded? It must be grounded on the simple authority of the Most High. God neither reveals what is untrue nor commands what is unjust. And therefore, the first principle of our moral duty is to know, acknowledge, and perform the divine will as the ultimate fact in the government of God over us. This question must be resolved altogether, irrespective of the state into which the fall has brought man, or otherwise God must cease to be God, and the creature must sit in judgment on his Creator. But alas, men in the enmity of their carnal mind and the pride of their heart dare to sit in judgment upon the rule God has given them, measuring it by how far they deem it suitable to their condition, how far it comports with their ability, how far it commends itself to their reason, which is the very essence of unbelief and rebellion, the opposite of faith and obedience. Responsibility rests not upon anything in the creature, but on the authority of God, who has made known his will to us. Responsibility is our obligation to respond to God's will. We turn next to consider the moral agency of man. Since God furnished all other creatures with faculties suited to and an ability to fill their several places and to attain their different ends, as fish to swim in water and birds to fly in the air, so he was no less gracious unto man. He who denied not capacity to his lower creatures withheld not the same from the noblest of his earthly works. How else could God have pronounced him very good, Genesis 1:31, if he lacked the natural capacity to answer the end of his creation? As he was to be made subject to moral government, man was endowed with moral agency. Man, then, has been fitted by his creation to serve his Maker, because he has been invested with faculties suited to the substance of the divine commands, and therefore, whatever laws God gives us, it is our bounden duty to obey. In amplifying what has just been said, we must seek answer to the question, what is the essence of moral agency? We answer, rational intelligence, volition or the power of choice, conscience or a moral sense. Rational intelligence, if man was incapable of comparing ideas, of marking their agreement or difference, to draw conclusions and infer results of conduct, he would not be a moral agent. That is to say, he would not be under a law or revealed will and liable to punishment for its violation or reward for its obedience. We do not treat infants or idiots or regard brute beasts as subjects of moral government. The unhappy maniac is pitied but not blamed. But something more than a capacity to reason is included in the idea of moral agency. There are processes of reason, such as a mathematical demonstration, which contain no moral character. Volition, or the power of choice. To will is an act of the mind directing its thoughts to the production of an action, and thereby exerting its power to produce it. The faculty of the will is that power or principle of the mind by which it is capable of choosing. An act of the will is simply a choice. When the herdsmen of Abraham and his nephew quarreled, the patriarch proposed a separation and graciously offered the young man his choice of the whole land. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Sodom. What does that choice signify? This: he took a view of the different localities, observed their relative features, balanced in his mind their respective advantages and disadvantages, and that which pleased him best offered the most powerful motive or incentive, and so was his choice. Such power of choice is necessary to constitute moral agency. Anyone who is physically forced to perform an act contrary to his desires, be it good or bad, is not accountable for it. Conscience, or a moral sense which discerns between moral good and evil, perceiving the difference between worthiness and blamableness, reward and punishment. A moral agent is one who has a capacity for being influenced in his actions by moral inducements or motives exhibited to the view of the understanding or reason, so as to engage to a conduct agreeable to the moral faculties. That such a faculty exists within us is borne witness to by the consciousness of men the world over. There is an inward monitor from whose authority there is no escape, ever accusing or excusing. When its authority is defied, sooner or later conscience smites the transgressor with deep remorse and causes him to shrink from the anticipations of a reckoning to come. In a healthy state, man recognizes the claims made by his moral faculty to supreme dominion over him. Thus, the Creator has placed within our own bosoms his vicegerent, ever testifying to our responsibility to render obedience unto him. But let us here repeat, man's responsibility rests not on anything within himself, but is based solely upon God's rights over him, his right to command, his right to be obeyed. The faculties of intelligence, volition, and conscience merely qualified man to discharge his responsibility. In addition to these faculties of his soul, man was also given strength or power to meet the requirements of his Maker. God made him upright, Ecclesiastes 7:29, placed within him holy dispositions which perceived the glory of God, a heart which responded to his excellency. Man was made in the image of God after his likeness, Genesis 1:27. In other words, he was created in righteousness and true holiness, Ephesians 4:25. Man's understanding was spiritually enlightened, his will rightly inclined, and therefore he was capacitated to love the Lord his God with all his faculties and to render unto him a sinless obedience. Thus was he fitted to discharge his responsibility. Should it be asked, how was it possible for such a creature, so richly endowed by his Creator, so very good in his being, so capacitated to love and serve his Maker, to fall? The answer is, because he was not constituted immutable, that is, incapable of any change. Creaturehood and mutability, liability to change, are correlative terms. Having bestowed upon man everything which was necessary to constitute him a moral agent, everything which fitted him to answer unto the divine requirements, man was made the subject of moral government, a rule of action being set before him, a rule which was vested with sanctions, reward for obedience, punishment for disobedience. Man then was put on probation under a covenant of works. He was duly tried, his fealty to God being tested by Satan. Man deliberately cast off his allegiance to God, rejected his authority, preferred the creature to his Creator, and thereby fell from his original estate. It needs to be pointed out, for in most circles of professing Christians, it is quite unknown that when God placed Adam under the covenant of works and put him on probation, he acted not simply as a private individual, but as a public person, as the federal head, as the legal representative and father of all his posterity. Such was the constitution which it pleased the Lord to appoint unto the human race at the beginning of its history. And whether we can or cannot perceive the propriety and righteousness of such an arrangement, no spiritual mind will doubt its wisdom or justice once he is satisfied it is definitely revealed in Holy Writ. Had Adam survived his testing and remained loyal to his ruler, the whole of his posterity had shared his reward. But instead, he rebelled and sinned, and in consequence, by the offense of one, judgment came upon all men to condemnation. By one man's disobedience, many were made sinners. Romans 5:18-19. In Adam, all die. 1 Corinthians 15:22. As the result of our federal head's transgression, we are born into this world depraved creatures, unable to render an acceptable obedience to the divine law. But the fall has neither changed man's relationship to God nor cancelled his responsibility. He is still a subject of the divine government, still a moral agent, still accountable for his actions, still required to love and serve the Lord his God. God has not lost his right to enforce his just demands, though man has lost his power to meet them. Depravity does not annul obligation. A human creditor may, without the slightest injustice, sue a prodigal debtor who has squandered his substance in riotous living. How much more so the divine creditor? The entrance of sin has neither weakened God's right to demand subjection from his creatures, nor invalidated their obligation to discharge their duty. In seeking to supply solution to the problem of how one who is morally impotent can be justly held to be fully accountable unto God, before we endeavor to point out more clearly the exact nature of that impotency, what it does not and what it does consist of, we deem it necessary to further amplify the remarks made in the preceding article, wherein we pointed out that we must first throw upon this problem the light which is furnished by the relationship which exists between the Creator and the creature, between God and fallen man. Unless we follow this order, we are certain to go wrong. It is only in God's light we can ever see light. God inhabits eternity. Man is but a thing of time. Since then God is both before and above man, we must start with God in our thoughts and descend to man. and not start with the present condition of fallen man and then seek to think backwards to God. That upon which we must first concentrate is not the rights of man, but the rights of God, the rights of God over man. The relation in which the Creator stands to His creatures makes them, in the strictest sense, His property. The Almighty has an absolute right to appropriate and control the products of His own omnipotence and will. Observe how the psalmist ascribes the supremacy of God to the dependence of all things upon Him for their original existence. For the Lord is a great God and a king above all gods. In His hand are the deep places of the earth. The strength of the hills is His also. The sea is His, and He made it, and His hands formed the dry land. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture and the sheep of His hand. Psalm 95, verses 3 to 7. Since creation itself gives the Most High an absolute right to the disposal of His creatures, His constant preservation of them continually augments His title. To keep in being calls for the exercise of power no less than to create out of nothing. To God as Creator, we owe our original existence. To God as Preserver, we are indebted for our continued existence. Upon this true foundation of creation and preservation, God possesses an unquestionable and inalienable propriety in all His creatures, and consequently they are under a corresponding obligation to acknowledge His dominion. Their dependence upon Him for past, present, and continued existence makes it a matter of imperative duty to submit to His authority. From the fact that we are His property, it follows that His will is our law. Shall the thing formed say unto Him that formed it, Why hast thou made me thus? Romans 9:20. God's right to govern us is the necessary consequence of the mutual relations existing between Creator and creatures. The dominion of God was not adjusted with reference to man, but man was constituted with reference to it. That is to say, it pleased the Lord to appoint and institute a system of moral government, and accordingly He constituted man a moral agent fitted to His requirements. Man was endowed with understanding, conscience, affections and will, capable of bearing the image of his Maker's holiness, of appreciating the distinctions between right and wrong, of feeling the supremacy of moral law. To such beings, God must sustain the relation of a ruler, for a moral creature is necessarily the subject of obligation. It must seek the law of its being beyond itself. The ultimate standard of its conduct must be found in a superior will to which it is responsible. Unto all created intelligences, the authority of their Creator is absolute, complete, and final. Thus the will of God, now expressed, is to them the sole standard of moral obligation. To deny this would be to make the creature independent. The essential elements which constitute all true government were present when God placed man in Eden. There was competent authority, a rule of action proclaimed, and a suitable sanction enforced that rule. As we have pointed out, the relationship subsisting between God and His creatures is such as to invest Him with an absolute right to exact obedience from them. As dependence is the very condition of his being, man possessed no authority to move, to exert a single faculty, or to lose a single quality without evoking the divine displeasure. So absolutely is the creature the property of its maker that it has no right to think its own thoughts or indulge its own inclinations. Moral agents must act, but their actions must be determined and regulated by the will of their maker. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat." Genesis 2:16. Without the grant, it had been an act of theft for Adam to have partaken of any of them. J.H. Thornwell, 1844, to whom we are indebted for much of this study, declared, "A creature had no more right to act than it has power to be without the consent of the Almighty. Dependence, absolute, complete, inalienable, is the law of its existence. Whatever it performs must be in the way of obedience. There can be no obedience without an indication of the will of a ruler, and no such indication without a government. It is, therefore, undeniably necessary that to justify a creature in acting at all, there must be some expression, more or less distinct, direct or indirect, of the will of its Creator. As then the Almighty, from the very necessity of the case, must will to establish some rule, we are prepared to inquire what kind of government he was pleased to institute." Unquote. As we mentioned in the preceding articles, it was a moral government of moral creatures who were placed under revealed law. It was a law to which was attached penal sanction, and this in the very nature of the case. In order to enforce his authority as ruler, in order to make manifest the estimate he places upon his law, God determined that disobedience thereto must be visited with summary punishment. How else could God's hatred of sin be known? Since the moral conduct of a creature is to be regulated with a specific reference to God's authority, unless he suffer it to be a God, uncontrolled, independent, there must be a recognition of his right to command. The actions of a moral creature must proceed from a sense of obligation corresponding to the rights of the ruler. But there could be no such sense of obligation unless the law was enforced by a penal sanction, for without such, the obedience of the creature would then be merely the result of persuasion rather than authority. A precept without penalty is simply advice, or at most, a request, and rewards without punishments are nothing but inducements. Had Adam and Eve been placed under such principles, which is precisely what most human government in the home, the church, and the state has now degenerated into, it would evidently be but a system of persuasion and not of authoritative rule. In such a case, their obedience would be nothing more than pleasing themselves following the impulse of their own desires and not submitting to the rightful demands of their Creator, which would be acting out their own wills and not the will of the Most High. It should be quite plain to the reader that such an inconceivable arrangement would have vested the creature with absolute sovereignty, making it a law unto itself, entirely independent of its maker. The essence of all morality is compliance with the will of God, not because it commends itself to our reason or is agreeable to our disposition, but simply because it is His will. Now, in order that the will of God may be felt as law and produce in the creature a corresponding sense of obligation, it must be enforced by a penal sanction.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the Papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the Papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."